Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. I have Brittany Spanos here from Rolling Stone. Hey, Brittany.
Hey.
And Rob Sheffield here as well. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Brian.
Rob's fifth book, which just came out, is called Dreaming the Beatles, the love story of one band and the whole world. It's premised on the very sharp point that the story of the Beatles didn't end when they broke up, that it was actually just the beginning. And it goes on to posit that there's such a thing as 80s Beatles, 90s Beatles, etc., in the sense that our perception and experience of them shifted over time. But it's also a very funny, very personal, very idiosyncratic love letter from Rob to the Beatles, even Ringo, especially Ringo even.
Especially Ringo.
And it is, of course, very much worth a read. So let me start by challenging you.
All right. I expect no less from you, Brian.
I expect no less from myself. You write that the Beatles are the world's greatest rock and roll band, words that I am sure you chose with purpose, words that are familiar from another band. Now, to me, the Beatles were, or are, the greatest something, but perhaps not that. But maybe you can defend and explain your decision to refer to them in those particular terms.
Well, the Mick Jagger-shaped elephant in the room is that the Rolling Stones, of course, very much made it their brand. While the Beatles were still a band, the Stones were calling themselves the world's greatest rock and roll band even before the Beatles broke up. And for me, the Beatles, their concept of rock and roll from the very beginning, that it included everything they liked, rockabilly, the blues, R&B, it included schlocky movie songs. You know, they liked to cover Ray Charles songs, and they liked to cover A Taste of Honey, stuff like that. Girl groups, songwriting for hire, country, it was all rock and roll to them. And that definition of rock and roll, probably like more like what we would now call pop music, but their expansive definition of rock and roll is what made stuff like the Stones possible.
So the fact that they didn't have a live career in the way that many subsequent bands did. They played under hilarious limitations, you know, where they couldn't hear themselves. And it is true that, as you say in the book, they acquit themselves in some recordings, and you can make a case for them as a strong live band. I just don't think you can make the case for being as good a live band as many of their contemporaries, or being as good as like The Who or The Stones or Zeppelin live. And they never gave themselves a chance to become that, right? Because they stopped before they even reached full maturity because they couldn't reproduce that stuff on stage and they were sick of not being able to hear themselves. So how does the lack of sort of a real live presence affect your assessment of them or your thinking about them?
Well, we'll never know whether they could have, if they'd chosen to keep playing live, whether they could have blown the rules away for that the way they did for blowing the rules away for making studio albums. And it's funny that in 1967, 68, those are such peak, like pivotal years in terms of how the whole idea of what a rock show is completely changing. That, you know, the Grateful Dead, like doing their massive marathon shows on the West Coast in 1967, the goalposts completely changed and the Beatles weren't playing in that league. They just dropped out before they got to the level. So we don't know whether they could have adapted to that the way the Stones certainly did.
Paul did eventually, of course.
Paul definitely did. But it's funny that
George did not.
But it's funny that, you know, like when you watch, you know, the Let It Be movie and the outtakes from that project, and it's all them preparing to play one show. And they're arguing so much about where to do this show. Ringo does not want to leave England for this show. Paul's like, no, we should go to Africa. And they're arguing so much over whether to have this, where to have this one show. And you think, wow, planning an entire tour, it would have distracted them from making music entirely, because they're so, like, the arguments they were having that make their records from that period so exciting and so creatively conflicted, that would have kept them from being able to plan a tour at all.
Why do you think George struggled so much on his infamous 70s tour?
He was maybe, he hadn't done it in a very long time, and maybe he underestimated the work involved. It was funny that for all the Beatles, they were really intimidated by live performance in the 70s. And it's easy to forget now because you go see Paul and he's playing such a marathon show. In the early 70s, he was touring with Wings and refusing to play any Beatles songs, and they did a lot of shows on English college campuses unannounced. And Paul said he stopped doing it because people would come up to him afterwards and complain about how, like, he wasn't playing Beatles songs anymore and how he didn't follow through on Sgt. Pepper. And for a lot of fans in the 70s, the idea of what rock was and what rock and roll was and what pop was changing. And to do that live, that was something that the Beatles were really intimidated by.
I remain fascinated with that George tour. You mentioned it, you know, In My Life. He did In My Life, not even his song, and then he changes the lyrics.
In My Life, I love God more.
Yeah.
You feel the groan from the soul. It's like, he's doing this song. Like, finally, like George, who we love so much, he's on stage and we can see he's in rough shape, and he does this song that we all know and love. Again, not even one of his songs. And he has to mess with it that way.
It's fascinating because you'd think that a Beatle or an ex-Beatle would, you know, get a vocal coach, because he was struggling with his voice. Now, instead, he just ground on. It's a crazy thing. It's very 70s. He was going through some stuff.
Yeah. But also, like, when the Beatles, when they were learning their chops as a live band, you know, it was all about, you know, just massive, you know, stimulus via, you know, adrenaline as well as artificial means to just go out there and do this super intense like half hour without stopping, and then just an equally frantic rush to the next town. And the whole sort of 70s laid back, I mean, you look at the people in George Harrison's band at that time, and they were used to doing, you know, really kind of, you know, mellow rock as opposed to rock and roll tours where, you know, stretching out, and, you know, there's all these different skills called for that George had never had to learn. But you listen to a lot of that stuff and it's like, wow, like he underestimated how difficult it would be to sing on stage for that long every night.
Have you had fantasies of seeing the Beatles in Hamburg? I know I have, especially after seeing Backbeat.
Absolutely. I have a friend, Doug Gilliard, who's in Guided by Voices and Not a Surf and lots of other bands. And he has a band who are a Hamburg Beatles cover band. And they do shows that are covering specific nights in Hamburg. Like they do the set list that the Beatles were doing.
Wow.
It's really, really fun because it's like they do a Carl Perkins cover and then they do a Sherelle song and then they do Somewhere Over the Rainbow and then they do I Saw Her Standing There. And it really is revelatory of how bizarre it was that they were learning their chops in this kind of environment.
I think John would maintain that that era of the Beatles could sort of kick the Stones' ass. I think that that was sort of... that was something one of the many, many, many angry points he wanted to get across to Jan in 1970 was how fierce the Beatles were and how maybe Brian Epstein and a lot of other things maybe softened their edges.
Yeah, I love there's a great part in that classic Lennon Remembers interview where he's saying that the Beatles, our best music was made, you know, in Hamburg before we got into a studio, and sort of saying, you know, we softened the edges, you know, we sold out basically like once we started playing shows that, you know, that people could actually go to see rather than just German gangsters. But you can sense how like just playing under those, you know, kind of like horrific combat zone kind of conditions, you know, sharpened the Beatles and made them the live band they were.
Lennon helped invent sort of the ultimate hipster stance on the band, which is they were not only better, you know, on their first album, they were better before anyone had heard them, besides a few drunken sailors. And
yeah, the hottest of takes.
I was
in the Beatles and like, but it's also funny how much in that interview he's talking about the Stones and, you know, Mick Jagger being, as John said, a little tardy about the Stones, about the Beatles, about, you know, Mick Jagger throwing shade at the Beatles not being as edgy as the Stones or as tough as the Stones, which he was keen to deflect.
And by the way, I should mention that we played about 45 minutes of Jan's incredible 1970 interview on last week's episode of Rolling Stone Music Now, which you can download. And it's well worth it. As I was saying, when you hear John saying these things that you've read all your life, It has a really different impact. It's fascinating. You make a convincing case that the Beatles transcended the 60s. Do you agree with that, Bernie?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the Beatles are... if someone were to get into, like, in, you know, this generation or whatever, and they're thinking about, like, listening to music outside of the last 10 years, like, the Beatles is always where everyone goes. I mean, their music is everywhere. Their music is referenced everywhere. I loved your entire chapter where you kind of talked about all those songs that reference the Beatles and the way that we see them. Because, I mean, even thinking about the fact that Black Beatles came out while you were writing this book and even before, like, that was a number one song, and then you released this book. And, yeah, so it's interesting how... no matter what, the Beatles are always sort of that entry drug to like everything else and to, you know, the 60s and 60s culture and, you know, rock music in general, the history of rock music. I mean, the Beatles are really that meeting point.
It's funny, when I was growing up in the 70s, and it was already really comical for my parents that my sisters and I wanted to listen to the Beatles all the time because they said, you know, that's over, that happened, that band broke up, they don't exist anymore. And it's funny that, you know, now my sisters, you know, now they're little kids. My nieces and nephews listen to the Beatles. My niece, you know, just learned to play Blackbird on guitar. She's, you know, it's funny that for all the predictions about when this music was supposed to last and when it was supposed to be over, the Beatles have outlived all those predictions.
Couple parts that randomly struck me in the book. First of all, when you realize to your great disappointment that the exciting sounding band Chicago Transit Authority was just Chicago.
It's really a buzzkill. Chicago Transit Authority is such an awesome name, and you look at that album, it's a double album and like got all these spooky song titles, you know, part one, part two, like all, like very like, you know, proggy, arty looking album. And then it's like, wait a minute, this is Chicago.
But more importantly, there's a point when one of the Bee Gees, I forget which, basically apparently once said in the 70s in one of the most obnoxious statements I've ever read, and I thought they were nice dudes, the Bee Gees, he said basically that there's no such thing as the Beatles are gone, therefore once we come out with our version of Sgt. Pepper's, it will be as if the old one never existed. Now, Rob, this is a real quote?
Actual quote. And it's funny that when the Bee Gees, who, you know, saw themselves like so many other 60s bands as, you know, the Beatles were the standard they wanted to meet. And, you know, the Beatles really epitomized what the Bee Gees wanted to aspire to in their creative evolution. So you can really, like, your heart goes out to the Bee Gees. They're the biggest band in the world. It's 1977. They're making Sgt. Pepper as a movie, starring themselves as Sgt. Pepper and his band, and starring Peter Frampton as Billy Shears. And they sincerely believe that people are going to, this is going to make people forget all about the Beatles.
And there was a real sense, a real divide between people who were older, like you said, who thought the Beatles were over, and the kids who were making their own version of the Beatles. And you point to this compilation, Rock and Roll Music, that was all wrong. It had a 50s cover. It drove Ringo crazy. But talk about that album, the Rock and Roll Music album. I'm going to explain again what it is.
It's a compilation that came out in 1976, and it's the Beatles basically as a 50s band who are doing, you know, it has all their cover versions. It's all fast songs. It's a double album set, and it's all fast songs, mostly early stuff. And the cover is this insanely cheesy 50s neon malt shop, you know, American Graffiti kind of motif. And obviously it's because kids loved Happy Days. You know, we loved the Fonz. And those of us who were like little kids in the 70s, we thought the Fonz was cool, which was bewildering to those of us who had parents who grew up in the 50s. I used to watch Happy Days with my parents, and they said none of these kids would have been allowed to hang out with Fonzie. And like, and if Fonzie went to that malt shop, the other kids would not have been allowed to go. And I went to see Grease in the theater with my parents, and they were laughing, and they said, trust us, we went to high school in the 50s. None of those girls would have liked Frankie Avalon. They were just like laughing at the pink ladies listening to Frankie Avalon. That this was something that Capitol tried to reckon with by putting out a really 50s-themed, oldies-themed Beatles cover that completely ignored all their progressive and psychedelic aspects.
It's sort of like if the Fonz had curated an album of Beatles songs. Is that
Yeah, absolutely. And so it completely ignores any of their ballads, any of their ambitious psychedelic works. And much to the Beatles' chagrin, this album not only comes out, which they find really offensive, they think the cover is hideous, they can't believe how ugly the graphics are, and it becomes a massive hit. It's the number two hit all through the summer of 1976, right behind Paul McCartney's Wings at the Speed of Sound. And it's funny that for the other Beatles, they were complaining about this compilation that they thought made them look cheesy and stupid and trivial, and yet they couldn't understand why kids of the 70s loved it and thought, this is our new favorite group. Got to Get You Into My Life became a top 10 hit single in 1976, 10 years after it came out. But it sounded phenomenal on the radio in between ABBA and Casey and the Sunshine Band.
And amazingly, that album is, or perhaps not so amazingly, the album is actually deleted. It just does not exist.
Yeah, they completely wrote that out of history.
It's the concept of deletion of albums from the catalog is a fascinating one. But anyway, so this is Rolling Stone Music Now. We're talking with Rob Sheffield about his new book on the Beatles, and we'll be right back with a lot more.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
Rob, if you were to encounter a human who had just arrived on Earth, and as we were saying earlier, this is not a theoretical phenomenon because every day there's people who want to introduce the Beatles to their kids. But if you wanted to introduce the Beatles to a, you know, to a non-child who had never heard the Beatles, where would you start to encapsulate them? What songs would you play? What albums would you play? How would you do this?
You know what? I would start with the song Help. Just because for me, that's where I came in. That's the first time I heard the Beatles. I was 5 years old and I was watching the movie Help on TV. And it's funny that there's so much going on just in that song that John is singing and telling his story, but also John is singing along with Paul and George, and the way that their vocals are bouncing off of his, and the way that, you know, they sort of join him in telling the story. When I was young, now my life has changed. And that... It just blew my mind as a little kid that, you know, there are these boys singing together and one of them is telling this really personal, soulful story and the other two are joining him and telling this story. For me, the whole story of the Beatles and their friendship is really in that song. If I had to pick one song to introduce somebody to the Beatles, I'd probably say the one that made me a fan.
Need somebody help, not just anybody help, you know I need someone.
One of the things that seems most important to me about that song is what John has to say about it. And it changes. It's one of those interview quotes that can really profoundly change the way you hear a song, which is that, you know, he wasn't kidding around. He really needed help, you know, that he was miserable and was reaching out and he needed someone, and that it was a cry from the heart, and actually one of the most sincere and personal Beatles songs written by him ever. You probably didn't know that, certainly when you were 5 years old. At some point, you learned that. How for you, does that change the way you hear that song?
You could totally hear it. It's, you know, it's funny when he talks about it in the Lennon Remembers interview with Jan, and he says, that's when we were eating marijuana for breakfast, and, you know, things were really insane. And yet you can hear that desperation in his voice, but like so many of John's really desperate, personal, soulful songs, it's a song that he's singing with other people, and that it's not a song. You listen to somebody cover Help when it's just them and a guitar, and it's a totally different song, and something really important is missing because the way the vocals blend is really part of the story of the song. I remember hearing that song and seeing them sing it on TV when I was a little kid, and I thought, this is what it looks like to have friends. Just imagine having friends like that you share that feeling of desperation with.
I always kind of thought of it as the backing vocals were the Help. If it's a solo acoustic song, it's just pretty tragic, you know, but the lift of the band and the backing vocals are the incarnate that, which is...
Yeah, like you listen to so many of John's saddest songs, like, you know, Babies in Black is another one, or Yes It Is, or even something like Norwegian Wood or Ticket to Ride. He does these really personal, soulful songs, and you can hear so much pain and honesty and rawness in his voice, but it would be a completely different song if it were a guy singing this song by himself. But that the other Beatles are joining in his story and telling him with it, that adds so much warmth and soul to it.
The flip side of introducing the world to the Beatles with a song is sort of the overlooked songs. And I very much agree with you about All Too Much. It's like a parallel universe Beatles song that people
totally,
forget about.
Totally.
You know, it may be the only Beatles song that Oasis actually heard. I think they don't actually know the rest
dude.
Of the catalog.
I love that. So Bonehead, just lock yourself up with this for a few months. So many bands have one famous song and it's nowhere near as good as this. Like, it's really funny how any other band would have made this the center of their legend.
Absolutely. Let's hear that.
Thank you.
I literally cannot remember when I first encountered that song, and it just kind of floats in the ether because I'm not a big listener to that particular album. But at some point, it definitely floated into my brain. Do you remember how you encountered that?
Yeah, watching the Yellow Submarine movie, where
the actual movie, yeah.
And my sisters and I,
which I've never seen, by the way. Yeah,
when my sisters and I were little kids in the 70s, and we would hold a tape recorder up to the TV when the Beatles movies were on, so we could like tape the songs from the movie. And Yellow Submarine, so it's funny, I really associate it with the version in the movie, which is slightly different from the version in the album. And it's funny that it was such a celebratory and joyous song, but also there's something really scary and menacing in the guitar. And so funny that they didn't even think this was a half-decent song. I mean, they left it off Magical Mystery Tour. So they were like, should we go with this one or Flying? No, let's go with Flying. You know,
it's a George prejudice, to be sure, I think.
But it's funny that even George, who wanted more songs on albums and more credit, like even George didn't think this was a very good song. And they just threw it away on the Yellow Submarine soundtrack. It's funny that any other song could have, any other band could have made a legend out of this song.
Well, you can pick in the same way of the Ludacris Rock and Roll compilation, and no offense to your childhood self, you could pick out veins of Beatles and make all sorts of compilations, like sort of crunchy power pop, like that, Paperback Writer. I think that might be my favorite sort of vein of Beatles. And it's funny, there's not that many bands where you can pick out just sort of individual veins and make whole sort of mini careers out of that, make whole mixtapes out of it. It's an interesting thing.
Totally, whole genres. I mean, it's funny that just in the snippet of It's All Too Much we heard, it's like first they invent Sonic Youth with the guitar, and then the organ comes in, and it's like, yes, 70s prog rock, we're giving birth to you right now. Like, that there's all this stuff going on, and that you can hear what all four Beatles are doing. I mean, Ringo is a monster in that song. I'm a strident pro-Ringo partisan.
Yes.
And that song is such a Ringo time capsule.
Monster is not a term one associates with him, but he is kind of a monster. And you kind of joke in your book that drummers disparage Ringo. I mean, I think a lot of drummers actually love Ringo because he knows how to play for the song. You know, he's the ultimate example
Absolutely.
Of a playing for the song guy. But he also has his moments that are, and I will say, playing Beatles Rock Band. Have you ever played that?
Yes.
Great game.
It's so fun.
Playing drums on Beatles Rock Band makes you realize that there's things like on Here Comes the Sun. Ringo kills it. There are some very tricky parts on a song like that, you know?
Brilliant example, yes. And a song that, you know, that's not one of the first 40 things you notice about Here Comes the Sun. There's so much going on in that song. And Ringo is so willing to be a support player. But yes, like, he's totally killing it in that song. And he kills it by making sure he doesn't overstep on anybody. He always said, my one rule is to always play with the singer. And it's something he's always doing.
I'd love to hear like the next three rules.
I'm not sure he has a lot of other rules. I don't even know if he has any other rules.
Bernie, what vein of Beatles has attracted you over the years? What's closest to your heart?
I mean, Rubber Soul is definitely my favorite Beatles album. So kind of their folkier moments has always been what I've been drawn to. But I also have a very, very strong affection for like very early Beatles. I Want to Hold Your Hand will forever be my favorite Beatles song. A lot of pop music is, especially pop groups, are really compared to and made in the vein of what the Beatles are and were. Like, every band wants to like get that type of reaction that the Beatles were getting that early on for these like really simple, beautiful love songs that they were writing. And that's always going to be
Sort of encapsulated ecstasy of I Want to Hold Your Hand is sort of the ideal, the platonic ideal of like sort of a boy band pop song, mm-hmm. you know.
And if they'd broken up after mm-hmm. that song, we'd still know their name now, because that song is just, and it's funny that you can pick out what all four of them are doing. Just the vocals alone in that song are completely insane.
And I just always love the concept of it. Just like, I Want to Hold Your Hand. It's so innocent, and it's so just like the most like sweetest, like tender thing that you can possibly say in a pop song. And it's perfect.
Yes. and so passionate in the way.
Yeah.
It's funny because every single time they sing the word hand, like, mm-hmm. you know, like your heart just surges. And it's funny that sometimes John just goes, and he can't even finish the word because he's screaming so hard. And just the raw emotion in that song, they're holding nothing back.
Yeah.
Again, on the flip side, one of the more obscure songs that you focus on is Yes It Is. It's one of the Beatles songs we were talking about, Fonzie's Beatles. This is, you know, Christine's Beatles, Christine being the spooky car from the Stephen King story that plays very ominous 50s rock and roll. This is Christine's Beatles. Let's hear that.
If you were red tonight, remember what I said.
I mean, that is, it's spine tingling and weirdly terrifying. There's a lot
creepy. Creepy. And again, all three of them sing. George's guitar is so creepy. The pedal steel, like, it's really disturbing. When I was a little kid and I loved, you know, I Want to Hold Your Hand and I loved She Loves You and I loved Penny Lane and I loved Here Comes the Sun. But yes, it is. I heard that. I was like, this is the worst Beatles song ever. It's really bumming me out. I never want to hear it again. It's really creepy. The Beatles had a lot of really scary moments, and that was definitely one of them.
You know, it's funny. Last night I was listening to them sing Money, to John sing Money, and for some reason it scared the hell out of me. It's really maniacally intense. I mean, people say things about performances, you know, it's a thing you say, but really when you listen to it, it is unhinged. And what I was picturing was like Donald Trump singing it. It's crazy how much there is there, but it's another weirdly scary Beatles
really
moment.
Really scary, yes. And it's funny, and they're doing this, you know, this great Motown song, Money, That's What I Want. And the way that John is just screaming like at the end, like, give me money, I want to be free. That's a line he added. And even the way John and is screaming this, and Paul and George are doing the whoo and the that's what I want, like, and it's really scary. It's demanding.
And that I Want to Be Free is certainly one of the great ad libs in pop history, you know.
Yeah, the Motown original was like all that pretty green, and John was, whether he heard it wrong or changed it, he was just like, I want to be free, and it's like,
oh, it never occurred to me that might have been the origin of that. That's interesting. Okay, it's not from nowhere. Interesting.
And another one, you listen to what Ringo's doing in that song, and it's like, okay, Ringo really wanted money. Ringo was like, you know, I'll blow the other three away. It's really like that sort of like early black leather gang mentality of the Beatles.
We'll hear that for a second. So I was thinking that we would go Beatle by Beatle.
All right.
You know, because you do that a bit in your book. Let's start with Ringo. You write a very sweet sort of defense of Ringo, and not just a defense, again, like sort of a love letter to Ringo. What do you love about Ringo?
Well, it's funny because Ringo, we love his personality. He's, you know, one of the most beloved men in the world. He has been for 50 years. Everybody loves Ringo, smiles when they say his name, and yet I think maybe we underrate him as a musician just because his personality tempts people to dismiss him. But he was the only Beatle who was hired for his playing. I mean, the Beatles hired him not because he was a nice guy, but because they needed a drummer who could actually like do offbeats, and they couldn't play songs like, you know, Money that we heard. They couldn't play these songs until they had a drummer who could do it. And Ringo was just ahead of, I mean, he wasn't just, you know, like the best drummer in Liverpool. He was one of the all-time great rock and roll drummers by the time they made their first record. As all the other Beatles said on more than one occasion, they could not have done what they did without Ringo. And as John said many times, he said Ringo was already a star in Liverpool before he joined the Beatles, and that he would have made it even without them.
Yeah, the sort of thing of that Ringo sucks or whatever, I think was part of it was from kids who just wanted to hear John Bonham or Keith Moon. It's just a different thing. And I think
God bless drummers.
Yeah.
Drummers are their own culture, and I respect deeply drummer culture. And as a non-member of drummer culture, but like, it's hilarious to hear drummers talk about Ringo. And it's funny. It's usually drummers who have a beef with Ringo's drumming. And then they're usually, and I'm like, oh, okay, go back to telling me about Steve Gadd or Terry Bozzio and why he was better than the guy who played on I Wanna Hold Your Hand. But it's just, you know, drummer culture is its own thing, and I respect it as a subculture unto itself without necessarily believing to it. It's like a religious cult or something. As Ringo says in the Help movie, not knocking anybody's religion or anything.
I felt the way you depicted Ringo's childhood, which I've read before, but something about it I found more affecting than before. Just the point that, as you say, a kindly musician or somebody came, and Ringo was in the children's ward. He was very sick all through his childhood. In that way, that non-specific way that thankfully, hopefully, isn't quite as much the case in more modern days of medicine. But he was just sick and missed so much school that his cousin had to teach him how to read. That's a huge bummer. And then, you know, so basically a kindly musician like brought in a drum and let him. He banged on a drum in the children's ward, which almost had me crying, honestly, the thought of it.
It's really moving. Yes. Ringo spent years at a time in the hospital and one day a music teacher just came into the children's ward and had musical instruments for the kid, and Ringo gravitated to the drum, and that was the first time he banged a drum, was in his hospital bed as a little kid who really wasn't expected to live long enough to see his 16th birthday. And that this is, you know, just how much of art history has been changed by the fact that this music teacher just visited the kids in the hospital that day. There was a great controversy, sorry to interrupt, great controversy a couple of years ago when he saw the movie Straight Outta Compton, and he said he liked it because it reminded him of growing up in Liverpool. And back in Liverpool, they were not necessarily jazzed about this Ringo comment. But he really, like, he had a very interesting life.
You didn't touch on the fact that Ringo went through a very prickly period in the press. I'm sure you're aware. There was a period when he'd be like, you know, there was just 8 years of my life. Like, why doesn't anyone ask about any other years? And it's like, well, you know, like, come on, man. Like, there's probably psychic burdens of being Ringo, I would imagine.
Yes, and I would say this applies to all four Beatles, that they cope with the psychic burden of being Beatles so much better than anybody could have expected, so much better than anybody else could have. I mean, it's kind of amazing when you think of the psychic burden of being a Beatle or an ex-Beatle. For just one day, none of us would be able to take it. We'd crumple like a Dorito. And it's amazing that, like, that Ringo, I mean, I think anybody would be prickly with that kind of burden. It's just kind of amazing that Ringo and Paul, that they still have so much grace with it, and that John and George did as well.
You were nodding when I talked about the Ringo chapter. What did you take away from that?
Well, it's my favorite chapter because I've always had a strong affection for Ringo, but I never really knew that much about him. Just like his personality in the movies and everything, I always really loved. And I love the anecdote that you have in there about Don't Let Me Down, where John like asked for support and for him to like bang the cymbal extra hard.
That's so beautiful, yeah.
To give me courage to really come in screaming, yeah.
Give me a big shh, give me the courage to come screaming in.
And I thought about it when we were talking about sort of like with help and how just like John is like sort of reaching out. I think that's like such a beautiful, especially that coming from the end of their career.
Yeah.
Just kind of like a beautiful sort of like full circle thing with how Ringo affected the band, but also their brotherhood between the four of them that is just inescapable no matter how hard they try.
Yeah. It's kind of, I guess a lot of groups and families and stuff, they have that one person has to be there in the room for the others to get along. And it's funny that it seemed like Ringo had that role.
Yeah.
How do you think Ringo felt when he first heard Joe Cocker's version of High With a Little Help From My Friends?
That's a very good question.
I never thought about that until this moment, whether he was like sort of chagrined or it was just like, hey, you know, I did my version and, you know, it's like... But I'm a big fan of Ringo's singing, really. I find it very charming, you know, perhaps not so much in the solo records, but, you know, in the context of a Beatles album, it really works.
Yeah, and it's funny that, you know, it's easy to forget when the Beatles broke up, he was the one who had the most initial solo success. He had two number one hits before John had one. Like, it's amazing that, you know, Ringo was the one who was racking up the solo hits in the early years. And
you had a comment in the book, which was that they were always generous with giving him songs because if you put it on his solo record, no one would hear them more than once, which was one of the meanest things you've ever written.
Sorry, but like, it's, and you listen to the late 70s Ringo records, and like, and you listen to a song like Cooking in the Kitchen of Love, which John wrote for him, and it's like, wow, like, John, like, that was just even kind of mean putting that song in the post. Like, Ringo, he inspires deep feelings from the other Beatles, and you can hear that come out in their music. That, you know, In My Life is a great example of a John song. We think of that as a John bearing his soul. But you listen to what Ringo's doing in that song, and he's really anchoring it emotionally. It wouldn't work without him, which is why any cover version of In My Life sounds silly, because Ringo isn't there.
Now, we love Ringo so much that we've barely left ourselves time for the other three Beatles.
Who cares about the other three?
We're going to talk about them all
Ringo
time.
And those other guys, yeah.
Ringo's gained his due.
Yeah.
This is perhaps a touch extreme in what we just did. But let's go to George. Where does George sit for you? And there's so much Beatle lore that you couldn't get to everything. And one of the things I don't think you got to was the hipster belief in the 2000s that George was the best Beatle. If you know what I'm talking about.
Hipster, we believed a lot of weird things in the 2000s, let's face it. And the thing is, like, George has always been, you know, he's a Beatle who doesn't quite fit into the group because, you know, they made him feel like an outsider a lot of the time. So he's someone, heart goes out to George, that he's someone who is worshipped around the world as, you know, brilliant guitarist, brilliant songwriter, brilliant musician, and yet the other guys in the band, they still treat him like, you know, the little kid who's just tagging along. And, and it's
economy class Beatles was what is his term for him and Ringo. Yeah.
I love that.
Strikingly self-aware.
Yeah. And it's funny. And we think of, like, you know, Paul as being the one like always telling George what to do. But you listen to the Get Back sessions and there's that heartbreaking moment where George is trying to get them to play All Things Must Pass. And John is so bored, he just starts playing a Chuck Berry song. And George says, that's it, I'm leaving. And he quits the band. Like right then and there, he just walks out of the studio and doesn't come back for a week. And it's crazy that the other Beatles were almost the only people that George couldn't get the respect and love that he craved from. And that brought out something that's often like very like dark and stern in his music. And yet, you know, there's something beautiful about the way he made music out of that.
And George was a very complex person. In Patty Boyd's book, which I know you've also read, she describes these switching back and forth between cocaine binges and spiritual binges that are some of the wildest personal crises that I've ever heard of anyone going through. And that is a very enjoyable book. I recommend, after I just said how horrible it's very enjoyable to read about these terrible things.
I love that book. Well, and you think about, you know, like the trauma, the psychic burden, as you said, what a beautiful phrase. I wish you'd said that when I'd still attempt to steal it for the book. But in terms of having to live your private life in public, and you know, with George, it's like it's not just that your marriage breaks up, it's that she leaves you for your best friend, and your best friend is Eric Clapton, and he writes his most famous song about it. I mean,
yes, your line that I love is there's public and then there's Layla.
Yeah, there was a great, you can find it on YouTube, there's this great 80s MTV interview with George when he around the time of Cloud Nine, and you can guess maybe the interviewer doesn't maybe know the full story of George and Eric, and the interviewer says, so Eric Clapton plays in this album, like how long have you guys been friends? And George just, he doesn't even crack a smile, he says, well we shared a wife. And there's this silence, and you could just like picture the interviewer just like breaking into six kinds of cold sweat. It is like really, I love Surly George, and that is seriously, seriously Surly George. He could bring the salt like no other Beatle. He's the one you'd be most afraid to like to get mad at you.
I also like the fact that you point out that, as you phrased it, that he got custody of Bob Dylan and the Beatles' divorce, which was very funny and very true. Let's do John. I mean, what is your kind of relationship to John? Like, how do you see him?
Really disturbing. I mean, I've John is the wild, out of control friend who, you know, you're always a little tense in your stomach that they're going to say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing. He was impulsive and rebellious and uncontrollable, and that comes out in his music in really beautiful ways, but also really disturbing and, as far as I'm concerned, obsessively beautiful ways.
And Paul is, you are, as you said in another interview recently, a conflicted Paul guy. He is, I guess, your Beatle of choice, but it's a complicated relationship, and I love that you let it play out. You can love him and mock him simultaneously, which I think is the right way to love things in pop. You know?
Well, serious Muppet fans like to talk about chaos Muppets versus order Muppets. Yes, and you know, John and Paul are the ultimate example of that. You know, John is the ultimate chaos Muppet, and Paul is the ultimate order Muppet. You know, they could not be more Ernie, could not be more Bert. And that something about Paul that I really, you know, relate to emotionally is the emotional extremes that he's driven to, sort of by this tormenting friendship that he has with John, and the way that friendship sort of gives him no peace, and the way they spur each other on to write such great songs. You know, that John writes Strawberry Fields Forever, and Paul is so blown away that he comes back a few days later with Penny Lane, you know? And these are songs that they did not write together, but they couldn't have been written except that these two guys were in competition.
Two things. The Elvis Costello cover of Penny Lane, have you ever heard it?
No.
It's fantastic. It's at the White House. And at the end, a member of the military band comes up and plays the horn solo. And it's so fantastic. And it just, I actually think it's probably my favorite version of Penny Lane, even more so than the Paul version. And then on another Elvis Costello related note, I talked to Elvis recently for the Flowers in the Dirt reissue that came out. And he made a great point about Paul, which is that Paul was refusing to allow himself to write in the harmonic structures even of the Beatles. He had to come up with an entire, he forced himself, he didn't have to, but he forced himself to come up with new harmonic and melodic languages to write in. He sort of broke up with the part of himself that was a Beatle. And Elvis said that people don't realize that, and people don't realize what a challenge he put on himself, and that he actually had huge hits while restricting himself that way is a fascinating thing. And I because, again, as we know, something like Back in the USSR is practically a Paul solo track. So Paul could incarnate the Beatles if he wanted to, solo in some ways, but yeah. he chose not to. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, really interesting. One of the reasons, Brittany, like you, Rubber Soul is my favorite, and I will stand for Rubber Soul till the day I die. I already have that planned out for my tombstone. Rubber Soul is the best. Rob Sheffield, like, da da da. But for me, like, the John Paul friendship, which is, you know, the heart of the band and something that, you know, that drives it emotionally, and the way that they share vocals all over that album. So something like, you know, Norwegian Wood, where, you know, you hear the way their voices blend, and there's during the bridge, John is singing the part that really sounds like Paul, and Paul is singing the part that really sounds like John. It's like they trade voices almost. They're almost reading each other's minds. And there's something about the deepness and intensity of that friendship that's part of what makes those records so compelling. It's really the emotional heart of the Beatles.
So you've been listening to Rolling Stone Music Now. We are talking with Brittany Spanos and with Rob Sheffield about his new book, Dreaming the Beatles, The Love Story of One Band and the Whole World. And thanks for being here, guys. And we will be back next week at 1 p.m. on Volume. In the meantime, be sure to download us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe as well. And we will see you next week.